All right, hello everybody. Welcome back, and welcome to what will be one of our really our last substantive section. So today what we're going to be talking about is ways in which you can create dynamic websites in a kind of a different way than what we've been seeing with PHP, by talking about how we can implement JavaScript within our XHTML files in order to provide a dynamic changing experience on the side of the user's web browser as they're making use of any services you implement within a website. We'll also be talking about the document object model, commonly referred to as the DOM for short, which is a way you'll be able to make use of JavaScript to access different parts of the web page and change it dynamically, as I mentioned, through the JavaScript to create a changing experience for the user, as well as talking about AJAX, or asynchronous JavaScript and XML calls, which will allow you to dynamically pull information off of other servers or off of other pages which you yourself have provided on your own server in order to change things on the page without actually refreshing the entire page, changing individual elements within the page to create a dynamic experience which you might have seen in other websites that you've used commonly. So let's begin by talking a little bit about JavaScript and what exactly it is. So JavaScript, like PHP, is a programming language which is used rather largely in terms of web design. It's used very closely with XHTML documents to create these web pages that can be passed to browsers and then be used to display something on the web through a web browser to an end user somewhere on the internet. So where these two languages differ is that PHP is a server-side executed language. It's whatever happens with PHP happens through a PHP interpreter, which is located on the server. You'll remember that we were using Chmod to set the permissions for our PHP files, so they couldn't actually be executed by any client-side users, anyone out on the internet that doesn't have access to our servers directly. They never got to actually execute that PHP code. It was all handled by an interpreter, which ran on the server itself, and then it would output some XHTML file and send that to the user so they could view it. JavaScript acts a little differently. What happens is that the JavaScript code is actually packaged within the XHTML file, which is passed to the user, and is interpreted by the browser rather than our server. So whatever browser your user happens to be using, whether it might be something like Google Chrome, Mozilla, Firefox, or Microsoft's Internet Explorer browser, is going to be taking in all your HTML formatted code, as well as this JavaScript code, which is included within the file, and then interpreting it on the fly in order to do whatever it is your page is designed to do through JavaScript to provide a changing dynamic experience. So let's talk a little more about JavaScript and some properties of the language. I've already mentioned that it's executed client-side. Much like PHP, it's also an interpreted language, as you might have gathered from the way I was talking about it. It's also something called a loosely typed language. We may not have used this particular way of expressing this idea previously in the course, but there are two types of programming languages. There are strongly typed languages as well as loosely typed languages. An example of a strongly typed language, which you're very familiar with by now, is the C programming language. And what strongly typed means is that when you declare a variable, you have to declare its type, and any value you put into that variable henceforth has to abide by that type. For example, in C, if I were to declare, for example, a variable x, and it was of type int, I wanted to store integer values in it, I would have to declare it as int x, and then anytime I put any values into this variable x, this location memory which is reserved for an integer, it has to be an integer, and it's going to be interpreted as such. I can't decide I'm just going to start putting characters in there and place them there and expect C to accommodate that. It's just not going to happen. That's not how the language is designed. It's optimized in such a way that the types have to correspond to the values that you're giving it. By comparison, if I were to use a language like JavaScript, which is loosely typed, I declare some variable x. Maybe I just write, I declare it as x. And then I decide, okay, I'm going to use x to hold the value 0. And then I decide I want to use that same value, the same variable name for something else. And I want to store a float now. So I put x equals 1.2. There should be semicolons here. That's okay. I can put a float in this value just the same as I would put this number previously. It doesn't make any difference. If I wanted to put some kind of a struct object here now, I could do that for perhaps some XHR object, which you'll be hearing more about later on. It's essentially like a struct like you saw in C. So now this is holding a struct, and that's okay. It's a loosely typed language, so this can actually hold anything, and JavaScript will change whatever it needs to under the hood to accommodate whatever we want to do. And just going one step further, we could have this contain a string as well. So you can clearly see here that JavaScript offers us a lot of flexibility that we don't see in a strongly typed language like C, but this is also something that you need to be aware of when you're programming in JavaScript or writing code in JavaScript, as you can't always count necessarily on what type of values you're going to see in a variable, because you do have this freedom to go ahead and change the type of values that you're passing in at any given time without JavaScript providing any warnings as a result, because this is something that's supported and something that you are allowed to do. So, yeah, that's something to watch out for when you're debugging in case such problems should arise in your code. Other properties of JavaScript to talk about. Let's see. Okay, so let's talk about how we would do variable and array declarations within JavaScript. The syntax for JavaScript is very similar to what you would normally see in C. Let's see, I'll just open up a file here and just show you. If I wanted to declare some variable to contain some value, much like I showed you over here, I can just put x, or more explicitly, maybe x equals 5. And what happens here is I'm initializing a global variable called x, which contains the number 5. If I wanted to make a local variable, then I would type var x equals 5. Note that in JavaScript, by default, variables are actually global. This is in stark contrast to what you've seen in other languages like C, where variables tend to be kept local to the function they're declared in, like if you declare it in the main function. And they're only really made global if they're declared outside a function. In the case of JavaScript, unless we specify with this var term that we want to make the variable local, it will be global. So you need to be very careful to declare things as local if you intend to use the same names for your variables in multiple functions, or if you don't want other functions to be stepping on your variables accidentally, perhaps if you mistakenly gave two things the same name, as this will create unexpected results. Okay, what else? Oh, certain operators that are very useful in the JavaScript language. We have plus, equals, equals, and type of. So plus obviously is a familiar symbol, but it has an additional functionality in C, or in JavaScript rather. You'll recall in PHP we had a concatenation operator, which was just simply a period. So if we had two strings, this is a string, and then we use this dot operator, and then this is another string. The result is that these two strings would be joined together into a single string. This is the same exact idea in JavaScript, except we now use this plus operator. So if you want to join two strings in JavaScript, you can just use this plus concatenation operator, and it'll essentially just glue the strings together for you, producing a new string. Let's see. Equals equals does pretty much what you'd expect it to do from C. If you have two values which are the same, it's going to compare them and return true. If they're different, it should return false. It's a little more powerful in JavaScript, however. For example, what if I had a string containing the characters 1, 2, 3, and I wanted to compare that to the number 123? What would you expect this to return? Based on your experience in C, you'd probably expect this to return false, because the string 1, 2, 3 is represented different in memory than the number, this integer value 123. But in fact, JavaScript is smart enough to look at this, intuit what exactly it is you mean, whether or not this value which we're representing as a string is the same as the value we're representing here as an integer, and will in fact return true given this case. So this is something that you can count on in JavaScript, and which you should take into account when you're considering how you're using your comparison operator within your JavaScript code, as it's a very powerful tool that you'll be given right up front. You'll also note that this means you'll never have to write a strcomp function or call a strcomp function, because if you have this is a string and this is a string, all you need is this comparison operator to tell you whether or not they're the same. This will return true. This is a string too. This would return false. It's comparing the entire string. It's just using the comparison operator. No extra functionality needed, or no extra functions needed. The functionality is included right there. Also, the type of operator, which is somewhat important. You recall that I mentioned that the comparison operator would compare two things despite their type to see if they were similar values. We had two things that were just type string as well as a type integer. and it would said since they had the same value that they were equivalent. If you need to check explicitly the type of something, for example, you want to know what is currently held in X, since you can't really count on what's going to be held in X, because as I said, this is a loosely typed language and you can really place any value in any variable that you want. Type of X will return whatever value type happens to be stored within that variable. Perhaps it might be a number, it might be a Boolean, it might be a string, an object, it could also be undefined or null in JavaScript. Any of these types would be valid and something that could possibly be returned by type of. Okay, just a couple more things pertaining to the JavaScript language before we get into the more interesting examples of how to implement these into web pages. We'll talk about, some of you might recall using switches in the Sudoku problem set, and you very likely don't recall using them any time since then. We haven't really given you many opportunities to make use of that particular statement in weeks past. You might also recall that when you were establishing your switch cases, your options were limited pretty much to integer values and characters. I don't know if any of you tried to use anything like a floating point value or a string, but you would have encountered issues if you had tried to do that. Not so in JavaScript. If you want to make a case a floating point value, if you want to make a case a string, or really anything you can imagine, then you can do that. That's absolutely valid and something you won't encounter an issue with. JavaScript, once again, gives you a lot of flexibility to do pretty much whatever you want. Also, a very useful construct is the for in construct. Some of you might have come across the for each construct in PHP, which is somewhat similar and also very useful. The for in construct allows you to take each element of an array and then automatically assign that to a specific variable name and do something with it without actually having to explicitly perform this declaration within your conditional block. For example, if I had suppose I have an array which contains 7 strings, and they're all the days of the week. Sunday, Monday, I won't bother typing them all out, but assume this contains the 7 strings Sunday through Saturday, all the days of the week being represented here. So if I wanted to print out all of these in C, then I'd have to declare something like this. Let's see, I less than, I suppose it'd be... We'll just hard code 7 here, bad form, but presumably we'd have some way of representing that, some function to get the length of it. Ignore the syntax highlighting. This isn't set up as a proper file for this. And then I suppose I'd print out, I'd call some print function, and I'd be referencing weekdays I to get what I'm getting there. By contrast, in JavaScript, I have this very easy-to-use syntax where I write for, then whatever I want to refer to each element as, for example, var day in weekdays, and then to access it, it's just day, because I've assigned each one for each iteration to this variable day. It's implicitly, it's implied right in this statement that for each weekday within that weekdays array, I want to set that value to day and then do something with it for each iteration. So I don't have to worry about referring to the element within the array and giving that some local variable name or dealing with that somewhat cumbersome syntax throughout my function or throughout my my code block. I'm simply able to assign it implicitly to variable day and then do something with it using this very handy JavaScript syntax. Okay. So that concludes the somewhat dry little lecture on the JavaScript syntax and really basic ways of just writing out code in JavaScript. Outside of that, largely, you'll notice that JavaScript, the way you're writing code, the way syntax is implemented within JavaScript is largely similar to C. You might find some small differences, but there's a lot of documentation you can find online to address any other discrepancies, but largely you're pretty much prepared for the way you're going to want to write JavaScript code at this point. One more interesting thing which JavaScript allows is the use of event handlers. If you think all the way back to the Scratch problem set, you'll remember that we could sometimes broadcast events, and then when we received them somewhere else in the code, we could do something that we had planned on doing when we got that event. This concept's coming back right now, actually, with JavaScript. We're able to set up event handlers, which allow functions to be called when something is done somewhere else in the code, which we'll see is very useful in the context of dynamic websites using JavaScript. So let's take a look at an example of an HTML file which contains a little bit of JavaScript, just to get an idea of how this is going to be implemented and what you might be expected to do in the upcoming problem set. So you'll see here, this is a fairly standard looking XHTML page. I have this header information you recall up here just to declare that I'm using transitional XHTML, not really pertinent to what I'm actually doing with the HTML formatting, so just don't worry about that. Within the head, you'll notice I have something other than just a title, which is what we were really putting up there before. I now have this script tag, and it has an attribute called type, which is equal to text/JavaScript. So I'm essentially telling the browser, okay, here comes some script, and it's in JavaScript. Just prepare for this. So the browser essentially can look at this and say, okay, I want to look at this with my JavaScript interpreter. And you'll notice here we have another tag here, just a left angle bracket, bang, left square bracket, cdata, left square bracket, then our JavaScript, and then the right angle bracket. This is commented out from our JavaScript using the double slash, which is how you would comment out a single line, much like in C in JavaScript, so that the JavaScript interpreter is not reading that, but that the XHTML parser essentially is seeing that there is code coming up here and to not print it on the screen. Essentially, all you really need to know is that if you want to put JavaScript in the header of your page, you need to put script type equals text JavaScript, and then this little bit of syntax here, which needs to necessarily surround whatever JavaScript code you're inlining into your HTML file. So just remember to always put that around whatever code you're going to include. You notice here that I have apparently included a function called do the same thing for whatever reason. The way I declare a function is by writing function, do the same thing, and then within these curly braces, whatever code I want to be executed. Okay. That seems simple enough. It even looks fairly similar to what we were doing in C before. So let's go down to the body of the page and see what I'm doing here. So hold on. Just to stay in line with how I've named things. So. Okay, so what do we have here? In our body tag, we have this attribute here called onClick, and it's apparently being assigned a string value, which, after I change it, will be correct. Okay, which seems to contain a function call. It's actually JavaScript code, which is being assigned, apparently, to this onClick attribute. And what onClick is an event handler, which, much as like it sounds, is a handler which looks out for when the body is clicked, so when I click on this body text, presumably, and then it's something that reacts to that event happening by calling whatever code I've included here in my assignment to the event handler. So let's go ahead and save this and see if this actually is going to work out in the way I expect it to. So if I pull up JavaScript example 1, and I'll go ahead and refresh it to get my changes, and I click here, okay. So what this alert function apparently is doing, and I'm sure you've seen this in your time browsing the web as well, these annoying little alert windows, is calling up this little pop-up window, this JavaScript alert, and printing out a message on the screen saying, you clicked in the body, nice, congratulating me for my good work. So what essentially is happening here is we're setting up an event handler, we're telling the browser, okay, when someone clicks on this body, I want you to call this JavaScript function, which I'm including here. Terminated by the semicolon. Notice that's important. This is legitimately a line of JavaScript code, essentially. And this event handler is holding on to that, waiting in the background for this to happen, and then when it does happen, when someone does in fact click on that body text, it calls this code. So I don't actually have to write out all this code here. If I were to rather write do the same thing, I can make use of the code which I've already provided in my header, these functions which I've declared, or in this case just this one function, and it will be called much in the same way that code was just executed previously. So if I now refresh to get the changes I've made to my page, and I click here, it does exactly the same thing. So you'll see there just how I can include some JavaScript code in the header, call it as a function, or if I'd prefer, inline just some random statement and assign it to an event handler, which will react to the event happening by calling that code. Does anyone have any questions about what I did there? Okay. So the next example moves beyond just the simple JavaScript functionality we've been talking about, and involves a little bit of a what I referred to previously as the document object model. So essentially, when the browser is handling this document, this XHTML document, this web page that it's dealing with, it breaks it up into various attributes. So essentially, the document you can think of as kind of the parent. If you like, you could think of it as the DOM as being sort of a directory structure which manages different parts of your web page. You'll see here that I have different elements spread throughout my page which have IDs. So I'm giving these inputs, and you'll remember from PSET 7, these are essentially of type text, so they're just little text boxes. And they're these input elements that are just strewn throughout the page with these corresponding IDs, little names essentially, like text 1 and text 2. And if you think of the DOM as just a way of managing all the things which are located throughout my page, you could think of the document as being the top level. And then it has children, essentially, which can be referenced by their ID. Maybe this element text 1. Maybe this element text 2. And these have properties as well. For example, if you recall previously from last week, if I wanted to have one of these text boxes have a default value, for example, I want it to say type in here, so that when I loaded the page, type in here was displayed within that text box, I'm essentially giving this element a value. So that's an attribute for text 1 then, value. And if I start at the top level and get more and more specific, I'm able to access these individual properties using the Document Object Manager. And the way I do that is by writing things like this. You'll notice here I have two local variables being created, and I'm setting them to these somewhat cryptic-looking statements. document.getElementById text1.value. Okay, so what's happening here? So we're going to our document, which is essentially the top level, which contains all the relevant things we're going to want to get access to on our web page. Then we're saying getElementById text1. So if you recall, I've given these different input elements IDs, and I've named a one text 1 and one text 2. So when I say get element by ID text 1, what's essentially happening is I'm looking through my document, I'm looking for the element that has ID text 1, and I'm getting that. So I'm stopping when I get to this point saying, okay, find that object, find that input box, and I'm getting that, and I'm placing that in here essentially, if you want to think about it that way, just to add a layer of abstraction. And then when I say dot value, I'm getting even more specific. Just going one more level, finding a property of this text 1 input element, and I'm getting its value. So essentially food is going to be, in this case, set equal to type in here, since that's the value of this element on the page. Normally it would be set to a null value or just undefined when we start the page, since we want to have a blank box for the user to type in, unless we want to prompt them somehow with some message, which we can do through this. Okay, so I'm essentially on click for this division of the page, which you'll notice is a sentence which says, click on this sentence for an incredulous response, which gives a bit of a hint as to what exactly I'm trying to do with this JavaScript. Apparently in some way, by using this on click event handler, I'm calling some function, which is apparently several lines of JavaScript, which is going to produce some sort of incredulous response based on whatever values have been provided to text 1 and text 2, these two ID'd elements which are located elsewhere in my page. So once again, you'll notice I'm setting these local variables to whatever the values in the two text boxes are, and then I'm calling an alert function, and once again, notice I'm calling multiple statements within this event handler by separating them with semicolons. I am able to call multiple statements at once without creating a function. I can simply inline them into this string, and all that JavaScript will in fact be executed. And then I'm calling this alert function, which is gluing together the strings your favorite food is with whatever the variable food is, whatever has been provided in that first text box, then gluing on the string and your favorite class is, and then once again I have a concatenation operator, and then whatever variable class is, which once again is just what's in box text 2, and then I'm adding an interrobang, hence incredulous response. And you'll notice that if I pull up this example, I put in pizza and CS50, and then I click on this sentence, I do in fact get an incredulous response. This string is being concatenated to contain the values I've provided, and then everything is being glued together, and the alert function is being called. So I'm able essentially to change what's happening on the page by altering what these fields are. Chinese food, sure. And I do, in fact, get a different response from the alert function. This is something that's happening dynamically on the client side without ever having to reach out to the server again. If I were to disconnect from the internet now, this is still code which is held by my browser and being interpreted by it, so I could continue to keep doing this. This isn't requiring any other interaction. The client is able to execute this code on its own without any interpretation being done by the server, and the browser essentially is able to interpret this JavaScript code and provide a dynamic experience. Okay, is everyone comfortable with what we've seen so far using the document object model and just some basic JavaScript code? Okay, so I'm going to bring up what might be considered a slightly more sophisticated example, in some ways at least. So hopefully this works as I put it together. So you're going to notice a lot of things happening all at once, and just ways in which the page is going to be changed by JavaScript. Just to give you a sense of exactly how powerful JavaScript is in providing this dynamic experience, as JavaScript is, in fact, able to pretty much through the document object model change everything about the page. So without further ado. Okay, so you'll see here that I'm essentially calling JavaScript functions which are bringing up these images and playing this music when I want them to in a dynamic way through the use of these functions that you'll see later how I've implemented them. I've created these tables which contains these elements wherever I want to place them. And then I also have these buttons here which presumably when I click them are going to produce some response through a JavaScript call. So if I click on Fire Blast, for example, Charizard's strongest move, Charizard used Fire Blast. It's super effective. Wild Pokemon defeated, and you can hear the victory music chime in there just to let me know that I did good. Okay, so let's take a look at exactly how I implemented this particular example. You guys don't look as if you're feeling as nostalgic as my class yesterday. Perhaps the wrong crowd. Okay, so let's first take a look at what is admittedly some rather convoluted HTML. Essentially, I've just set up an onload event handler within the body, and I realize that the red text is a little hard to see on the screen, so I'll explain this in depth, what exactly I'm doing here. Body onload is calling something called setTimeout, which takes two arguments. It takes a JavaScript function as well as an integer, which represents a time in milliseconds. So essentially what I'm doing is saying that when I load the page, after 5.585 seconds, I want to call Pokemon appears. The reason I did this, just to provide some justification, is that about 5.585 seconds after the music starts, we get a particular sound effect that corresponds to when we want the Pokemon to pop out. So it just adds an additional effect. And it's a way of demonstrating how we can have just some code being executed after the fact, after we've initiated this statement. Asynchronously, which is something we'll talk a little bit more about later on in the section. We also have a lot of structuring here using tables, setting up particular borders just to create that that effect of the square around the entire screen, like on the Game Boy. We have an XHTML comment here. If this syntax has alluded you thus far, if you include a tag, which just includes an exclamation point, two dashes, a comment, and then two dashes, and then the right angle bracket. That's a properly formatted XHTML comment. It has no effect, rather than to inform whoever happens to be reading your code what exactly is going on here. I chose to include one here to highlight that all this is formatting for the enemy Pokemon's row of the table contained within that large box. I'm also giving these intuitive ID names to different divisions of the page so that I can reach out to them later and change things about them. You notice here I'm including just some style attributes to change the way things are displayed, as well as alignment, and just a little text here. A little more of the same throughout here. Very similar idea here, yet another table inline just to help structure things a little better. And down here, you'll notice we have four submit buttons, which I'm using outside of the context of a form coupled with these event handlers on click. What this essentially says here, again, I know the red text is a little hard to see on the screen, so I'll describe this so anyone watching will understand what's going on. Input type equals submit, on click equals a function called attack, and the value is whatever the name of the move is. You'll notice there are four different moves on the page. They actually all do the same thing. I didn't implement something different for each one. So essentially what is happening is when I click on one of these buttons, I'm calling the function attack, which is going to do something. Using these input buttons in a slightly unorthodox way, since they're usually accompanied with forms for submission of something through perhaps through PHP to another page, or using PHP to another page. Let's see. And this down here is just for the messages at the bottom of the screen, and some embedded music, which I can also access through this div ID. Okay. So having taken a cursory look at all this XHTML code, which is included down here, let's take a look at some of the functions which were implemented to give us a better idea of exactly what we're doing with JavaScript to create these dynamic effects in the web browser. So the first thing that gets called, as you recall, is about 5.5 seconds after the page is loaded, we call this Pokemon Appears function. And what's happening here is that I'm getting the elements by ID, enemy Pokemon, and enemy Pokemon stats, which you recall are the two divisions of the page which are at the top row of my table, which contained Alakazam, the picture of that Pokemon, and just the stats on the left side of the screen, the Pokemon's level, his name, his hit points. I'm getting those, and by accessing this inner HTML attribute, I'm able to dynamically change the content of that division. Inner HTML means access the HTML code, which is within that division of the page, which is essentially everything you've written within like tags and plain text between those two divisions, and change it to whatever I feel like. Just overwrite it completely and put whatever HTML code I now want to place there. So you might have noticed previously within enemy Pokemon, I had something called No Alakazam, just kind of a hackish name for a blank bitmap file, which has the same width and height as the Alakazam picture does, just so that it wouldn't appear, but it would still maintain the same width and height of the appropriate table cell. A very hackish way of doing that, but just the way I ended up doing it very quickly to get the example done. And now we're placing in a different image tag, which has a different image as its source with the particular width and height that I want, so that we're essentially changing the picture, which is located within that division of the page, to the picture of the Pokemon, so he appears to pop up. The wild Pokemon appears at the scripted time. And you'll notice here that I've written a function called message, which actually says the wild Pokemon appeared. This function simply gets by its element ID the input field message, and then changes its inner HTML to reflect the contents of a string which is being passed to the function. So just a very simple way of implementing functionality so that you don't have to type something like document.getElementById message every time you want to change the message on the screen, which is a nice way of consolidating that code down into something which is much easier to type, message, and then whatever your string is. And then you'll notice here I'm making use of the setTimeout function once again to wait about 1.5 seconds before I replace whatever I wrote within my message, which was wild Pokemon appeared, with a line break tag just to keep it one line long, but having it no longer contain any visible text. Okay. So, if not battle, what is battle? I haven't declared it in this particular function. Okay, so I have a global boolean called battle, which contains false initially, which I'm making use in other functions to keep track of whether or not I should be attacking at this particular time. I didn't show you this, but if I were to run this again, there we go, okay. You'll note that if I try to attack now, I can't do anything. These buttons don't work. Okay, now the wild Pokemon's appeared. Now the battle's begun. Battle has just been set to true. I can now make a move. I can do a flamethrower, for example, this time. Charizard uses flamethrower. It's super effective. But if I click the button again, it's not going to do anything. I'm not going to get the same result anymore because battle is now false. So you'll see there how I'm using a global variable in such a way that I can keep track of the conditions on the page and understand when I should be executing or should not be executing code. Just an example of how using a global variable is very handy in JavaScript because you're keeping track of all these things that are happening at the same time, potentially, particularly when you're considering event handlers, which can execute at any time depending on when the condition is fulfilled, when the event is triggered, rather. So I'm making use of that in void attack or function attack. And when this does not return false, when battle is true, I'm doing something with JavaScript here to get the event source element. What that syntax means is just what's the value of the element which triggered this event. If you remember, I was using a submit button, so its value happened to be whatever the name of the move was. So it was just kind of a cool little way of getting the name of the move and then inlining it in here. So I'm reacting to whatever button they chose to press. You'll notice when I clicked Fire Blast, I printed out use Fire Blast, as opposed to when I clicked Flamethrower, I typed it printed out use Flamethrower. And the way we did that was by getting the value string there by referencing event.sourceElement, where event is whatever happened to trigger this most recently, and sourceElement is the element on the page which triggered the event, as you would intuitively guess based on the name. So after we've gotten that element, I can then reference the value of that element, which was just that button, and the value being its name, inline it here using a string concatenation, and type out this message using my message function. I then set battle to false so that I won't be able to press the button and get a result anymore, because I don't want to interrupt whatever else is going on by just clicking the button madly and having it say use fire blast, use flamethrower, use slash. I'm waiting 2 seconds before I show wild Pokemon defeated, and then once again, I'm accessing elements on the page by their ID and giving these IDs and changing their inner HTML to first get rid of the picture of Alakazam to clear him out since he's defeated. He shouldn't be there anymore. I'm clearing out the stats for Alakazam because I don't want the information about the Pokemon to be there anymore without him, because it doesn't make sense to show it when he's not present. And also to actually change the music, because if you'll recall, I use an embed tag near the bottom to embed an MP3 file, which I'm going to have play as soon as the page is loaded, but be hidden so that the user doesn't actually see that big, ugly MP3 player like you might see on some pages, just hidden in the background to provide, I guess, that Pokemon battle ambiance. And then by using JavaScript, if I can find this function again, okay, I'm changing the HTML, so I'm actually including a new embed tag, overwriting the old one, getting rid of all the old inner HTML, and including a different embed tag, which, once again, this is a little hard to read on the video, but what it says is embed source equals music/win.mp3, which is a distinct MP3 file. So essentially, I'm including a reference to another MP3 file through a JavaScript call, and then the browser is reacting by immediately playing that new sound file. So I'm able to change the background music by using this JavaScript function when I reach the condition where I've won the Pokemon battle, essentially. So you can see how I'm making use of a variety of really relatively simple JavaScript tools to provide this, what appears, at least I think, to be a somewhat sophisticated example of just the ways you can use JavaScript to dynamically change the content on a web page and provide an interactive user experience. Does anyone have any questions about the particular types of statements that I was making use of here? The way I might have implemented them, something that seems a little weird? Okay. Okay, so that essentially exhausts the usefulness of this particular example. So let's move on now and talk a little about AJAX, which is something that's going to be very useful on your next problem set. Okay, so asynchronous JavaScript and XML is what AJAX stands for. It's not really a language or any particular structure or anything like that. It's just kind of a phrase which is used to refer to a certain type of action which is taken by JavaScript and a certain method by which we're able to transfer information between servers or even between web pages located on the same server asynchronously. And you recall that we were seeing situations in JavaScript previously using event handlers where we would say, okay, when this event happens, I want to execute this code, but it wasn't requiring that we actually iterated through our control flow and kept checking to see whether or not that event was actually triggered yet. We don't have to, for example, have a for loop where we're saying each iteration, okay, has this happened yet? Okay, then I'm going to respond this way. Has this happened yet? I'm going to respond this way. Has this happened yet? Okay, it's finally happened. I'll respond this different way. We don't have to do that. We don't have to worry about it in our control flow at all, because we kind of have some threading going under on just under the hood, behind the scenes. Using these events, we're able to check constantly through kind of a separate process whether or not the events happened, and we don't have to really worry about it because we have something off to the side, essentially, that's taking care of it for us, and it's not something we have to explicitly write into the rest of our code by virtue of the way event handlers work in JavaScript. So similarly, there's a way where we can asynchronously reach out and get information from another server and then pull it in and use it to dynamically change the content of our web page without having to refresh the page. This is what's really useful about AJAX. It allows us to change the content of our page and get new information inline into it without having to run a refresh operation. We're able to keep that same web page state going without interrupting it for the user, just keep everything the same and wait to get the new information that we want. And there are a lot of great examples of this. You don't have to look very far. I mean, just pull up Google, and if I start typing in, like, Himalayas, if I just type HIM, okay, so you'll see here I now have this new drop-down menu that just appeared out of nowhere. It's telling me all these apparently popular search terms that begin with HIM or something close to HIM, things I could have met, apparently. So how's this happening? I mean, it's not happening on my side. I don't have, like, Google's entire dictionary sitting in my browser that I can check against and then, like, just like this, bring up all these potential terms. What's happening here is that we're reaching across the internet to Google every time we type in a new character, telling it the string we've typed in so far. Google's getting this and then searching its dictionary, returning the most common search terms beginning with those with that string or something approximating that string, and then giving it to our browser, which responds using JavaScript by creating this new drop-down box, which shows us all these terms. And it happens just like that without us having to refresh our page. And if I type another letter, for example, just AS, I get something called Hamasaku, Hamanshu, Hemisphere, a misspelling of hemisphere, apparently. And this all happens just like that without having to refresh the page at all. And if I continue on my word and type in Himalayas, I even get a nice little link to the Wikipedia page for the Himalayas inlined right in there. And this is using AJAX. So you can see how it's a very useful term, just making these websites just these really nice interactive experiences that provide extra data to the user without having to worry about refreshing to fetch this data. How annoying would this be if every time that I typed in a few strings, I had to press a button, which then, using PHP or something, fetched the information from the server and then dynamically generated this new web page containing that information. I don't think I'd ever use it, because why would I type like half the word and then press the button to get the rest of the string and sit there and wait? But if it just pops up like this as I'm typing, well, that's really useful, because if I met Himalayas Restaurant, I can now just go down here and search for Himalayas Restaurant and get information based on that. So you can clearly see how this just appears all over the internet, especially in the last few years, and we don't really think about it anymore. It's just become kind of part of the web. So if you want to go forth and start making useful web pages, this is definitely going to be a useful skill to have, knowing how to make these AJAX calls in order to replicate these user experiences you see on other pages like Google. So let's take a look at some very simple examples of making an AJAX call. So if I pull up ajax.php, assuming this will, in fact, load for me. Okay, good. Okay, so you'll notice I'm structuring it much like just a regular HTML file. And here I am. I'm running into some JavaScript here. Okay, so what am I doing in my JavaScript? The first thing I'm doing, apparently, is declaring this XHR object, and I'm setting it equal to null. XML HTTP request is what I mean by XHR here. That's essentially my AJAX call. It's asynchronous JavaScript and XML. I can get back XML as well as HTTP information from this request. So it would be referred to as an XHR, an XML HTTP request, or an AJAX call. I'll probably refer to it as an AJAX call mostly for the rest of this. So using this function getInfo, I'm first notice this this interesting syntax try. So I try to create an XHR object through this call to new XML HTTP request. And if I can't do that, if I catch an error, then I'm setting equal to new ActiveX object of type Microsoft.XML HTTP. So essentially what I'm doing here is for new modern browsers which make use of this XML HTTP request object, I'm first doing that, If I'm unable to do that for some reason, usually because someone's using an old, outdated version of Internet Explorer, then I'm going to try to support them still and allow them to get this functionality by making this particular type of object, which has the same functionality, is just a little bit older and somewhat outdated at this point. If I'm unable to do that, it means they're using an old browser or one that wouldn't support an AJAX call, maybe like an alt-text browser like Lynx or something like that. And I'm just returning because I'm not going to be able to make the AJAX call, and I'm just providing them an alert saying, oh, AJAX unsupported, unable to do this. Okay. Next, I'm making a local variable called URL. I'm setting it equal to ajaxhelper.php, which just happens to be the name of the page which I've set up on my own server so that I can reach out and get information from that particular page. ajaxhelper.php, when called, is going to return the text that we want to get back from my AJAX call. And then getting element by ID progress, which is just a division of the page below, and I'm setting the style display to block. What that essentially means is that I want to show it. It's a square. It's a block. I want to show this square on the screen. Any division of the page is going to be rectangular just by nature of how we're formatting things. So block means show it. It's currently set to none, so it's currently not being shown. When I set it to block, it's going to show whatever's there. It's just a tacky little progress bar thing like you probably saw David use in lecture, commonly used for AJAX calls like this. Then we're finally ready to send out this XML HTTP request. And the way we do that is by setting this event handler, which is an attribute of XHR, because XHR is an object, which is like a struct in C. It contains various attributes, including an event handler called onReadyStateChange, which we're setting equal to handler. If you recall the way we did things in JavaScript, when we set an event handler to something, we're setting it to the function we want to call when that event is triggered. So when whatever ReadyStateChange changes, we want to call handler to handle that change. We'll get back to what exactly that means in just a moment. I want to run through these last two lines here. Then we're opening our connection. It's a get method. You recall the difference between the get and post method. Get includes the information within the URL so that the PHP code can access it through the get array, that $_get_associative array. We're including the URL we want to reach out to. And then this third argument is a Boolean value, which represents true or false, whether or not it's an asynchronous event. Since we do want this just to run in the background while we do other things, it's asynchronous. It's an asynchronous JavaScript and XML call. Then we set that to true. XHR.send, we send it out. So we've essentially, at this point, after this function is called and we've executed all this code, we've sent our request to the other server, and we're awaiting its response. So handler, when it gets a ready state change, is going to check if the ready state is 4. There's various states of the ready state. It starts out at 0, and it's going to update as the progress of our AJAX call moves along. When it gets to 4, that means it's done and it's returned. If you're interested in finding out what the other states mean, you can look them up, but essentially what you really need to know is that when the ready state is 4, the AJAX call has been completed, and your handler should do something. First thing I'm doing is hiding our progress bar, because it doesn't make sense to show the AJAX progress bar when we're no longer making progress because we're done. What I'm then doing is checking if the XHR status is equal to 200. That status is basically the type of status you'd see from a web page when you send a request using your browser to get a page. You might be familiar with errors such as 404, file not found, or 403, forbidden, particularly after last week's problems. I'm sure everyone ran into that at least once, just forgetting to chmod something correctly. And you've never seen 200 appear on your window because 200 means it worked. And they're never going to show you that the status message when it's working for you. They're just going to give you the content. So you'll want to see if you did, in fact, get what you wanted from your XML HTTP request or AJAX call by checking if the status is equal to 200. If it is, then we can go ahead and place within this element, apparently, which is where I want to place my output. I have a nice little div called output, apparently. Get element by ID. This is output. And within the inner HTML, whatever HTML is contained within that region of the page, I'm setting it equal to xhr.responseText. And note, particularly when I'm using these terms like in the DOM and also within my XHR, terms are generally formatted such that the first word, if it's a multi-word attribute, is not capitalized. All further attributes are capitalized. And also document here is all lowercase. If it's just a one-word attribute, it's lowercase. keep that in mind. If you type it wrong, it won't work. And you'll bang your head against the wall for hours trying to figure out why your code isn't working when you just forgot to make D lowercase or capitalize E or something. Just keep that in mind. Also, ID, capital I, lowercase d, not capital I, capital D. Just little things to make note of now so that you save yourself frustration later. Going back to what we were talking about, xhr.responseText represents the text that was returned in the AJAX call, whatever we got from that PHP document. And you'll see just by nature of setting this equal to the inner HTML of output, I'm essentially taking whatever we got and placing it within this output area. If something went wrong, we print the alert XHR fail. Hopefully that shouldn't happen. And you'll notice here that I'm just calling this when I hit submit on when I submit my form by clicking on this button. And let's take a look at what happens. So if I bring up ajax1.php. Oh, I think it's just ajax.php, actually. Okay. 403 forbidden, if anyone hadn't encountered that before. So I click on this button. You'll notice I very briefly, this is a really quick call, got that animation, and then it was hidden, and we say, hey, look at that. And I didn't show you this to you previously, but if I open ajaxhelper.php, all this file contained all along was, hey, look at that. So I reached out to this file from the other file. Without having to refresh the page, I got the information and printed it out on the screen. So that's not very interesting, but if I bring up ajax2.php, you'll see that I'm making a very similar call. You'll notice the formatting is very similar. I'm doing pretty much a lot of the same work to make that this XHR object so I can make my call. Now I'm just getting these two values from the page, which I've typed into x1 and x2. I'm assuming they're going to be two numbers. I'm not checking their type or anything to do any error checking like that. This is just a simple example. So don't take this as necessarily the perfect way to do this. But I'm assuming I'm getting numbers, x and y here, two operands. The URL here is ajaxhelper2.php, x equals, and then I'm inlining the value of x here, which I've gotten from the web page's DOM, and y, and telling me I'm now, this ampersand symbol telling me I'm getting a new variable, y equals, and then I'm inlining this variable y, which I've also gotten from the DOM, the second text box, and then showing my stupid little display, my progress bar again. Sending this out using the handler. The handler works pretty much exactly the same, except now I'm putting the response text in some ID called product, because if you notice that this is a function called multiply. So what's essentially happening is I'm getting two values from two separate areas of the DOM, which are essentially going to provide these two number values, which have been provided by the user to me. And then I'm going to make an AJAX call, which will presumably result in some remote PHP file performing multiplication, and then returning the product to me. So I'm not actually performing the multiplication operation. I'm having a server somewhere else or a page somewhere else to do it for me using PHP, and then return the results to me so that I can make use of computational power somewhere else or a special function somewhere else to get information and pull it back in a way that's slightly more interesting than what we did before. So very similarly up down here, I have a table where, once again, I have IDs equal X1, ID equal X2. They're just these text boxes. I'll show you what the page looks like so you can get a visual. So essentially, I've created this, which is ID X1, this, which is ID X2, and this, which is ID product, just these text input boxes. I also have a form submission button, which apparently has the value do it, do the math. And this is passing to AJAX helper 2, if you recall, .php. And you'll see here I have a very simple little PHP command included at the top of the file, echo get x times get y. So I'm taking in these x and y values, I'm multiplying them, printing to this file the value, whatever x times y is. If x is 5, y is 4, this is going to print out 20 to the file, then return the text of this file. That's going to be the XHR response text, and I should see that show up within the value of my product box. So if I make this, make something interesting, 512 times 8, 4096. So you'll notice that animation briefly appeared, and then we saw the value come up. If I change this again to times 9, it'll happen again. and I get my new value. So I'm in asynchronously making use of JavaScript to make a call to a remote server or a remote page also on the server, which contains PHP code, and I'm making use of that code to get a value based on these arguments I'm providing to dynamically change my web page and alter what the user is seeing on the browser without ever having to refresh the page. And that's essentially JavaScript, Ajax, and that hopefully will prepare you for what you're going to have to do for this week's problem set. All right. That's all for this week. Thanks, guys.